Thanks, Sarah. Okay. Let me just get this up. Bear with me 1 second. Okay, so I would like to welcome everyone to the meeting. Hopefully everyone can hear me clearly. Everyone should ensure their mobile cell phones are turned off or switched to silent, and the use of mobile devices for recording is not permitted. Members of the public should not speak during the meeting and may be temporarily excluded for discussion of in-committee items. Members of the public and press must refrain from using the instant messaging facility during the meeting, and anyone found to be doing so will be given a warning. Failing to adhere to the guidelines for second time will result in being removed from the meeting. I would remind members of their obligation under the Councillor's Code of Conduct to declare any financial or significant non-financial interests which they have in any item of business before the committee today. If you have such an interest, please either declare it now or immediately before the item, stating the item of business it relates to. Having declared an interest, members should leave the chamber or hang up from the call for the duration of the discussion on that item and should not take part in the vote. You will then be invited back to join the meeting once the discussion on that item has ended. The proceedings of the meeting will be audio and video recorded, except where Council is considering any exempt matters. The recording equipment is linked to the microphone system on the computer, so please ensure your microphone is switched on before speaking. Members are reminded that they are personally responsible for any comments they make at the meeting. Please ensure if you wish to speak on an item, either in the chamber or via Teams, use the chat facility to indicate your wish to speak, and I will bring members in as listed. I would remind members to keep their instant messages to the following letters. Type Q if you wish to ask a question, or C for a comment. Type P if you wish to propose. Type S if you wish to second. Please refrain from making any other comments using instant messaging. If you need to leave the meeting early, please indicate via chat facility so that we are aware this is an active decision and does not indicate connectivity problems. So thanks for that. I want to give a further welcome to NIAS Mark Cochran, Assistant Director of Operations, Southern Trust, Catherine Reid, Director of Surgery and Clinical Services, Brian Beattie, Director of Adult Community, Paula Talley, Assistant Director of Performance and Reform, Southeastern Trust, Roisin Coulter, Chief Executive, Rachel Gibbs, Director of Adult Services and Healthcare in Prisons, and Claire Campbell, Engagement and Involvement Manager. So you are all very welcome. Bear with me, because I'm not just as good as Michael Savage at this, but we'll go with it. Okay, so apologies. I have Councillor Lee Surgner, Councillor McMurray, Councillor Rice, Councillor Brennan, Councillor Murphy, Councillor O'Murray, and Councillor Hart. Is there any others, Sarah, that I'm not aware of?
Yes, Chair. We have Councillor Kearns, King, and yeah, you've got Lee Surgner. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, thanks for that.
Sorry, one for Councillor Hannah there, please, as well.
Thank you. That's grand. So we'll move on to item number 2, declarations of interest, if there is any. None, okay. So item 3 is the letter that we sent to NIAS, and Mark Cochran, you are going to come in on that, if you will.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the opportunity to be here this evening to provide an overview of just our service delivery in the council area, give you some idea of where our performance is at the moment, some of the challenges we are facing, and then afford the opportunity to ask any questions the council may have. I have a presentation, if I can share that. If anybody can provide me with advice around that.
I think Sarah is going to be available to you, Sarah, yeah?
Do you want us to share, or are you going to share it, Mark?
I can share it from this end if you want.
Yeah, if you want to go ahead.
So can everybody see that?
No, not yet, Mark.
Okay. Let me try this. Any joy now?
No.
Nothing as yet.
No. Might have to revert then to the one that emailed to you.
Yeah, no problem. I can share for you. If you just let me know then when you need to move on sites.
Yeah, will do. Okay, so just to run you through that, if you want to go to the first slide then for me. So our service delivery model in this council area straddles two of our operational divisions. That comprises 5 24-hour ambulance stations located, and this is the next slide as well, sorry, located in Newry, Kilkeel, Ballinahinch, Newcastle and Downpatrick. In terms of cover levels then, what we provide across the council area on a daily basis is 14 crews split across the day shift and night shift, 7 on each. We also have 4 rapid response vehicles. Those are the cars operated by a paramedic running between the hours of 7 in the morning and midnight. And then we have a non-emergency transport service comprising 6 crews. One of the questions that was asked in advance was around our staffing level. So just to give council some idea at the moment, our funded establishment across the council area is 58 paramedics. We're currently sitting at 96% compliance with that, and that's 56. We're funded for 38 EMTs, and we have 33. So each of our frontline ambulances will be staffed by a paramedic and an EMT. And then in relation to the non-emergency staff, funded for 17, and we have 15 in place. And those are all supported by a team of operational managers and various support services. Currently, in terms of recruitment plans for this year, they're really restricted to qualified paramedics or newly qualified paramedics, because we're still, we have commenced our Bachelor of Science degree course for paramedicine, and that's the students on that next year will be their final year, so we'll be recruiting from their own qualified paramedics trained here at the Ulster University. We also plan to recruit 1 course of emergency medical technicians to help address the shortfall in that grade of staff. So we'll just go to the next slide, please. In terms of activity in the council area, so in terms of our overall, it accounts for about 8% of the total activity of the ambulance service, and this is based on the calendar year of 2022. In total, we had about 17,300 incidents in this council area, the majority of which are occurring in the Newry catchment area and then Downpatrick. We categorise all our calls into 1, 2, 3 and 4, with 1 being the highest priority. Those are the calls that are emergency life-threatening. And in terms just of the number of each of those categories of calls throughout the area, this council area, it's not overrepresented in any particular group or category of call. Interestingly, it is the busiest LCG area for HEMS calls. And in the calendar year 2022, the helicopter flew 90 missions into the council area. So we'll just move to the next slide. Response times. Each of the categories has a predetermined response time, performance standard against it. In terms of category 1, the standard there we're aiming for is 8 minutes. Regionally, we're not achieving that standard, and certainly in the LCG, we're not achieving that. In fact, we're almost double it at 16 minutes. I should remark that is actually the worst performing council area in terms of category 1 response in Northern Ireland. You can see there for yourself the other categories of calls, and just in particular in this area, the Newcastle catchment area would be where we've experienced the biggest challenges in terms of our category 1 calls. If we can move on to the next slide then. So in terms of challenges we're currently facing, the biggest one would be around capacity. Then we've some changes to service configuration, which are both within our control and outside of our control. We still have ongoing industrial action, and there is the financial position, and I've put the word uncertain in front of it, and I think those two words go together now, no matter where we go, uncertain financial position. And again, the next slide, I'll just elaborate slightly on some of those. In terms of capacity, our biggest challenge remains extended ambulance handovers. We work very closely with our partners in the HSC Trusts to minimise these. We have certain protections in place as well to ensure that we can release ambulances for Category 1 calls with minimal delay. But it represents somewhere over 25% of our total capacity is lost to ambulance, extended ambulance handover times. We continue to wait for the outcome of our clinical response model, which is really about trying to expand the service, increase the footprint of our staffing levels and our crews throughout the region, but in particularly in this LCG. And we have ambitious plans there, but again, we have to wait the outcome of that business case. The service configuration, actually I'll come back to service configuration in a moment, but we do also have a problem with high absence rates. As an ambulance service, our absence is the highest in the UK, and it's beyond that of our colleagues in the National Ambulance Service as well, and that represents a big challenge to us. If I could just move to the next slide. When we talk about service configuration, so these are changes which come about either as a result of pressures in other HSC trusts or indeed some of our own changes, as I mentioned. This just highlights, even though the figures are low, the recent change, for example, in emergency service provision or emergency surgery provision within the Daisy Hill Hospital. This graph here just shows you at February 22 when this temporary change was introduced, how our numbers increased, clear increase in the number of calls being moved to Craig Avon from postcode areas that would normally be seen as the catchment for Daisy Hill. And the next slide then, that shows you the number or the slight increase in transfers from Daisy Hill Hospital interfacility transfers up to Craig Avon. Not, I might say, all as a result of the changes in emergency surgery, but it coincided with that reconfiguration. This really amounts to somewhere just short of two calls a day for us, but in an organisation which is already struggling with capacity issues, already struggling with poor performance and response times, you can see clearly the pressure that puts on us then. So in terms of maybe some more positive news, within the LCG there are a number of community first responder groups. I'm happy to say that this first slide, even though I've done these last week, it's now out of date, because just over the weekend, the Mourns Community First Response Scheme trained an additional 10 staff, so their numbers have now grown to 26. And since going live, the group would receive around 14 alerts per month. Sleeve Crew, again, just they're down around 11 alerts per month. And then the final CFR group in the areas in Cross MacLean, and they're receiving around 7 alerts per month. We work very closely with community first response teams, both in terms of providing the training, providing them with support services in relation to their own health and well-being, and also in developing those organisations. And we're happy to listen to any group who wishes to establish a similar scheme. Just to finish off, last time I came to council, it was a passing comment I had made which sparked a bit of interest, and that was around aggression and aggressive incidents towards our staff. So I thought I would include a slide, that's the next slide. And this one just shows, broken down into this, to the five stations that comprise this council area, the number of assaults that we've had on our staff in the calendar year 2022. Those can range from a verbal assault right through to some very serious acts of aggression which have involved weapons. The figures don't include assaults on our control room staff, which are largely all verbal, obviously. But because they're not attached to these particular stations in this council group, they're not included in there. And my final slide before going to questions, and I don't want to think I'm going to avoid questions, but following our last council meeting, we were contacted by a couple of councillors, and we're very grateful for that. This just shows the visit that happened as a result of that. And this slide is really an opportunity for me on behalf of my Chief Executive and Director of Operations to say thank you to the Council for the support that you continue to show us and have shown us over this current term. I believe this is probably our last opportunity to visit before Council elections in May. So thank you for your support, and I wish all of you well, those who are faced going to re-election and those who are retiring. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to take those.
Thank you, Mark. I see the first question, comments and question is in from Una Hanlon.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thanks very much, Mark, for the taking the time to give us the presentation. I just wanted to pick up on your comment that we're the worst performing council area for response times. That is obviously really worrying, you know, for us as elected reps in the Newry Morning Down area. You talked about support from council. You referenced there that a few elected reps had gone to meet you. You know, what can we do to help you with that particular challenge? And the second question I would have is around, there's notable high level of staff absence. What support is given to those staff in order to encourage them to get back to work if possible? It's obviously a very challenging environment for them in terms of the, as you touched on, the abuse that they face, and also, you know, maybe being caught at the likes of the Ulster in huge queues as well. It must be very demoralising for them. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Councillor Hanlon. So in terms of help, firstly, in terms of our own, what we do for ourselves, we endeavour to comply as closely as we can with our funded establishment figures. That has improved significantly over the last months. And indeed, I can remember coming to council before where we were talking about drop crew levels in the double figures, high teens. So thankfully now our compliance is usually in and around 95 to high 90% threshold. In terms of any additional help, obviously we're waiting on a business case, so anything we can do there to support that. And I would urge them as well, councillors, if they can with their constituents with regard to advice and the proper use of the service, I certainly wouldn't discourage anyone from calling for an ambulance, but we continue to see high numbers of calls really where ambulances are maybe as a result of maybe not being able to get other services, but really through a lack of understanding as well of what an ambulance is about. So anything in terms of education, and we're happy to come along and talk to any kind of group as well if that would help. But your continued support there would be welcome. In terms of our staff absence, we have just recently revised our attendance policy, so that's quite a robust process now. We have a very proactive staff welfare support system where crews will be debriefed in relation to incidents, both immediately and then in the follow-up days as well. You're right, it can be very demoralising, and we hear that quite a lot from staff when they're delayed in terms of handovers. And they can't really be doing what they're supposed to be doing. So we continue, as I say, to work with our partners there in the HSC Trust to reduce those. We introduced an initiative back in December. You'll be aware of the Chief Executive's initiative around backstops at hospitals, trying to reduce those to no more than 3 hours. That was quite successful to the point we were introducing a 2-hour backstop, but unfortunately the pressures have started to build again within the system. And we're seeing those start to grow.
Thank you. Just the next question then there from Councillor Byrne.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I'm not going to repeat the question that we asked. I was going to make similar comments, but just to touch in a different angle. Seeing you talking about the category on calls and the worst across the district that Daniel alluded to there, I mean, obviously that's very worrying, but we've got an average in those category one response times, and that is significantly increased in rural areas. And the last time that we had met, maybe not the last time, maybe a previous meeting over the last couple of years, we got response times broken down into certain DEAs. And that is quite helpful because you've got extensive response times that are skewing that figure, you know, the average. Whereas you might be making it in time, underneath the time that you're trying to hit the calls in certain urban areas, but you're certainly not doing it in rural areas, and that's pulling it up. And as elected reps, and certainly for myself, in Sligo Gullion DEA, we would like a breakdown of the response times across our DEA because they're a lot more than 18 minutes. It also, you did touch on first responders and the fantastic job that they're doing in areas where we've got obviously a lack of provision, lack of infrastructure, but there's increased pressure put on those groups and they do a fantastic job, but we cannot be seen to rely more and more and more on them, and that's what's happening. So that's not sustainable going forward. You touched on the new clinical response model, and I think the previous meeting that we had here, we touched on that as well, but we're still awaiting it. And where is the business case? Where is it sitting? What is the time frame for getting things moving? Because obviously we need to change the system of how you're operating now, because it's clearly not fit for purpose or not working in terms of changes that's been made at certain hospitals. You talked about emergency surgery there. We simply don't have the infrastructure, and your presentation has shown that we don't have the infrastructure in terms of crews to actually meet the response times if we're driving people to Craigavon, never mind the road infrastructure. So be keen to know more about the business case and where we are in the clinical response model, because all we're going to get at these presentations then is more bad news, more targets missed, and then a promise that we're trying to move things on with the new clinical response model, but where is it? So that's the key. That's the key thing here that we need a bit of direction on. But yeah, please, if after this meeting we can break down the figures around the DEAs so we have an idea of response times. But I'd like to get some comeback on the clinical response model there.
Okay, certainly. Thanks, Councillor Bourne. And I can certainly arrange for you to have those figures forwarded to council for sure. My understanding of the clinical response model, that it still sits with the department. And it's subject to business case approval. That's really the level that I'm at in terms of knowing where it's at the moment. I can't give you a timeline. I can't give you any indication of when that might be. I can only give you an assurance that we have the plan in place. We've actually began we've actually taken a bit of a risk in terms of recruitment around some of this. So we are already in some of our stations. Newry would be a prime example of that. We are over-established in relation to our paramedics at the moment, in the hope and expectation that we will actually get that approval, or certainly some limited approval to begin the first phase of that. But I can certainly get you the DEA figures that you've requested, and I'll get you an update then as well from the Chief in relation to business case.
Yeah, thanks for that. And Chair, just to add that, if it's still waiting, it's still with the department waiting for approval, does that take a minister to be in place, or do you know if that approval can be made without a minister in place? Is it being held up because we don't have a minister in place?
Sorry, is that directed to me, Councillor?
Yeah, it is, Mark. Yeah. Obviously, the business case is still sitting in the department waiting for approval. Is there a hold up because we don't have a minister in place, or is it able to be advanced despite not having a minister in place? And so, what I'm asking is, it the politics here that's holding it up, and that's why it's not been approved?
Well, I'm probably not expert enough to give that, but I understand that these decisions can be approved by the permanent secretary, as far as I know. But again, I'll confirm that.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Carlin. Councillor Carlin, can I
Yeah. Let me come in now. Just very briefly, and listen to what you were saying this morning.
Yeah, very sure about that. Just in relation to, I noticed here that absentee is still very high in Irvine, and what has been done to try and overcome that? And why is it, why it has been, the last time you made a presentation here too, it was very high too as well. And what has been done? There must be some reason for this high absentee, and it will have a fallback on your staff. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Councillor Curran. The main reason for our absence, or the highest sort of reason, is stress-related matters. So, as I say, we provide a very robust peer support process for our staff to try and manage through that. We also have quite high musculoskeletal absence rates, and again, we provide training and support for staff in relation to best practice, and probably where we need to do better in relation to that is to maintain that training with regular updates, etc. And our well, they say when you have to rely on policy, then that's not really the correct way to do things. But we do have challenges as well around managing staff back to work. But as I say, our attendance management policy has recently been revised, and we would be optimistic that that will support staff in a better way, providing alternatives to get them back into work again, building towards them being back on operational duty.
Yes. Thank
you for that. Councillor Clark.
Thanks very much, Chair. And Mark, thanks very much for the presentation. I missed the very beginning of it, but it's very informative. First of all, I'd like to pay tribute to the ambulance staff. You know, there's been a lot, you know, since COVID, the pressures that that brought. And also now that you've mentioned in regards to the tax on the ambulance crews, I find that disgusting, you know, that people trying to help people are facing such abuse. It's the same with the fire crews, it's the same with the PSNI, and it seems to be getting out of control. And when the assembly gets up and running again, it's something the Justice Department certainly have to look at, you know, in regards to sentencing. And to put a stop to this activity, this is not acceptable. That people, there's a big enough stress in people's jobs, ambulance crews, without this abuse also. Just in regards to my own constituency, Mark, in the Mourns, feedback from constituents, you know, who have used the ambulance service, have spoken about, you know, long delays in ambulances, getting, particularly in rural areas, like Councillor Byrne was saying, and, you know, the likes of the Clacoos and the Glasrumans and the Analongs, you know, that there is delays, major delays, and just, as you said, the Council Board, if I could have maybe a breakdown of them figures also, it would be very useful. But if you can pass on, you know, our support for the ambulance crews, and we understand they're working under great pressure, you know, to get the calls, and it's not about, you know, the staff, the frontline staff and that, you know, there is, as Council Byrne also said, in regards to the timeline in the business case, you know, if that could be brought quickly, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Councillor Clark, and I certainly will feed your comments back to staff. I do acknowledge, you know, and particularly in the very rural areas, the challenge it is extremely difficult to get resources there in a timely fashion. And would offer just reassurance that all of our calls are triaged according to clinical need and prioritised in that fashion, and where we can't immediately get a response to those most serious of calls, we do provide telephone advice, not a substitute, not ideal at all, but just another layer of support that we try to offer.
Okay.
Thank you.
So there's a question from Councillor McIntyre.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, as well. And again, thank you, Mark, for your presentation. And again, I'm going to echo the sentiments of people as well who've spoken so far about the service that you try to offer. And you are the very first point of contact in very difficult situations. And I suppose, and it's totally wrong at the end of the day for you, for the service, to be put in such a position that you're not able to give a timely response, and then you are victims then of the ensuing rage and anger that takes place on criticism, where while it's being directed in the wrong place. And in that vein, I just wanted to expand on that a little bit, but trying to understand actually where the problem lies. And I think that is what would really need, everybody needs to really work on. The impression, or at least the impression that the Southern Trust would give when I speak to them, is that the lack of care packages is availability does impact greatly on the admissions system at one end of the hospital. So, and the other part, there's one aspect to it. And the follow-on question from that then is that, is there a direct link between the patient discharges from A&E hospital and admissions? Is that actually clear in every absolute case? And the other part then is the handovers that you mentioned. Have they been made more difficult with any new protocols that have been introduced in the last number of years that delays that process? And finally, what do you think could be done to improve all that? And I know the issue of care packaging is certainly one aspect to it, and that lays outside your hands. But are there other solutions that you think are possible that maybe you're having difficulty getting agreement on? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your comments. Again, I'll feed those back as well to staff. In relation to the handovers, it's well recognised, and my colleagues from both South and South East Trust could speak more to this than me, but this is not a problem that, you know, that when we turn up at a casualty department that someone said, no, you can't come in because we want the break or whatever. You know, this is purely capacity issues, and our colleagues in ED can't get their patients out of ED, can't get them onto the wards because the wards can't get them out and back into to the community settings again. So, you know, we are a symptom of that with ambulances queuing. And when we have ambulances queuing, obviously, we can't respond to people in the community, which is where our priority lies. So that is a fact, and a well-recognised fact. It's also a well-recognised fact that when a patient is queuing in an ambulance, that, you know, if for every patient who waits, for every 10 patients who wait more than an hour in an ambulance, 9 of those will experience some sort of harm as a result of that delay. And one of those will actually experience significant harm. So those are well rehearsed facts. So, you know, anything that we can do and anything we can get support with to help in terms of alleviating those pressures would be welcome. But it's I'm sure my colleagues can testify to this. It's what we do every day. It's what we focus on every day of our working life now. It's about improving that situation. It's something when I joined the ambulance service that was unheard of, and you asked me, is there anything we can do to improve it? It's not within my gift, but personally, when we could admit patients directly to wards, that we never had delays, and we've seen a little bit of that with the new model of emergency surgery, where we can transfer patients directly from Daisy Hill up to wards in Craigavon, but I know that's probably not achievable. And in terms of the other thing we can do is to try as far as we can to reduce attendances at ED. So we're working very closely with the trusts around alternative care pathways. So looking at different ways of providing care to people in the community or in other facilities. The direct admissions unit in Daisy Hill Hospital is an example. The single point of contact for the urgent care centre at the Down Hospital. Perfect examples of how we can do things differently. And we continue to work with colleagues around those. A lot of that, unfortunately, I come back to that financing, it does come down to funding. So those are the challenges we face. But, you know, those are the kind of things that will improve the situation as well.
Yep. Okay. So just to clarify, yeah, are all then, you know, are all the blockages at the front really associated with those care packages that have been hard to deliver? Is that the entire problem?
Well, I couldn't say that all of them are, Councillor, but I mean, as I say, it's about capacity, so don't.
Just lost you there.
Mark, we've lost you.
Yeah, certainly.
I just lost him.
I'm trying to turn off the camera to see if that improves it.
Yeah. Right, try that again there, Mark.
I tried turning off the camera there, so I don't know if you can hear me now.
Perfect, Mark, yes. Go.
Okay, so you'll be glad to know then I'll keep the camera off. So yeah, anything, as I say, was anything that can improve the potential to get patients out of the hospital and create that capacity, and then in turn for us, anything which can stop us bringing patients to casualty, then those initiatives would certainly improve the situation.
Yeah, thanks, Anna. Mark, thank you.
Thank you. Brian, are you looking in there?
Yes, it was just to say, in fairness to Mark, part of the question that was asked in relation to domiciliary care and the relationship between delayed ability to offload, it may well be that that would be better answered, that part of it, by ourselves or South East. So I'm happy at the start of our part, if you want, that I would give comment on that. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Brian. Mark, I'm just going to ask you, could you turn your mic off because there's a bit of interference if you don't mind? Yeah, perfect. No worries. Lucas, thanks for all your comments, Mark. I just want to pick up as well. I know it's been covered by other councillors. They say that Newry Mourne Down is the worst performing in council area. And I think just to bring home, I think we can look at all the statistics and read that time and time again. And the devastating, as you mentioned, the devastating effects that the delays can have. I would be doing a disservice to Jodie did I not mention. I don't often talk of personal matters, but my own cousin was sadly died on the street as a result of delays from the ambulance service. Huge delays. And the devastating fact is, yes, something could have been done for her laying on the streets of Newry from a head injury. Not only maybe could it have saved her life, but it could have made the lives of her family very, very different. It maybe could have meant that she got into the back of an ambulance, was worked on, and died with a bit of dignity in a hospital bed. And I think certainly for our family, it was absolutely devastating that has happened, and something that I don't think her mother or any of us will ever recover from. So, you know, I suppose the question that I would ask is, what is the ambulance service doing to improve the service and change being the worst performing council area? Because it's still upsetting to hear that. Thank you.
Chair, and, you know, I would express my condolences again, and I know we have done that as well, and I don't say what I said in relation to performance lightly, but I'd be doing you and your fellow councillors a disservice by not identifying that as well. It's important that council is aware of that. The particular incident that you refer to was, and I appreciate your family will never get over that, never. But I think people like me in the ambulance service as well who live in this area will never forget that either. Because that and without going into the particular ins and outs of it, in relation to some of the findings of that investigation following that, were things that we could have done better, and we have addressed and hopefully now do better to ensure provision of service it doesn't take away from the fact that it's still, in terms of Category 1s, a 16-minute response time, which is double what it should be. And even when it's at 8 minutes, that's still not sufficient in many cases. In addition to all of the things I've said below, I think learning from things like that is very, very important. And I would offer you an assurance that that is the case. And hopefully practices have changed in relation to some aspects of that that have improved that situation.
Thank you, Mark. Councillor Henry, or Henry Riley, sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry to hear your story there. I would also send my condolences to you, even at this late time. Mark, I was talking to an ambulance man quite recently, and he suggested that the roads in the Mourns area are so bad at occasions that they have to go slower than they would in other areas. And he even said about the road between Newcastle and Kilkeel, if you have a patient with a spinal injury, some of those humps and bumps and potholes are so bad that it can have a potentially adverse effect. And I was just wondering, Mark, do you know, have any of your vehicles sustained damage because of the presence of potholes? And what's your views on the condition of the roads in regards to the ambulance service? You know, is it factual that spinal injury patients and other patients, can be affected by poor road services? Also, what Chairwoman said about Newry Morning Down being the worst in the area, you know, that is shocking to hear that. And it's something that I've long suspected, but, we really do rely on you to bring forward the plans to get that up to speed and get us up to the national norm. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Councillor Riley. Firstly, a number of words about ambulances that have sustained damage as a result of potholes. That's not something that they could well come off the road for whatever reason. Because let's face it, no matter where we go, there are potholes everywhere. And I would say, though, that all our staff are trained to a very high standard when it comes to driving duties and responsibilities, so they drive according to the condition of the road and the clinical presentation of their patient in the back, and also with the safety of everyone on board, including the attendant in the back of the ambulance, in mind. In terms of plans to get that reduced, to say, I've talked about several different measures, but I think I have to be honest as well with council here that, you know, as I said, our major issue is one of capacity. We currently do not have the resources to respond to the calls that we get in the time frames that we're expected to do that, and that's the reality of the situation. And I think even if I had, you know, even a couple more ambulances at the moment, that still wouldn't make dramatic inroads on that performance time in the Newry Morning Down area at the moment.
Sorry, I missed your first bit, Mark. You were coming over garbled with the electronics, but thanks very much.
Thank you, Councillor Riley. If there's anything, I suppose, Councillor Riley, that you feel you missed, that you would like clarified, would you be happy enough, Mark, maybe for him to get a question over to you, and you can answer it again. Do you want to do that, Councillor Riley? Or?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. I'm happy to do that with any councillor. I mean, you have my contact details, and we're happy to respond to any question, or you have my telephone number as well. No issues.
Brilliant. Thanks for that. That's grand. Okay, so if there's no other questions, I will move on to item number 4, which is the Southern Trust. So I will let Catherine, Brian and Paula come on that if you're happy enough.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to come tonight. In particular, we want to do a presentation around our consultation for the review of emergency general surgery. We have a short video to start off with, and then there's a presentation, and I'd like to introduce you all to Amy Nelson, the head of surgery, who will do the presentation on behalf of the Southern Trust.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. If it's okay, I'll go ahead and try and share my screen to see if we can do the presentation. Can you see? Can anybody see my screen yet?
No.
No? Okay, hold on. Always the way of technical difficulties. Let me just try again. Okay. Can you see that now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to try and play this and we'll see if it'll go ahead. Is that playing okay?
It's no volume, Amy.
Okay, don't know how to do that.
Amy, hover at the bottom of the screen. You may be presented with an opportunity to slide that volume.
Is that full volume? So hopefully, sorry if you can hear, there was just music behind all of that. Can you hear me talking?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. So thank you very much. I am, as Catherine said, I am the head of general surgeries. I'm going to do you a quick kind of overview of what's going on at the moment with general surgery in particular. I'm going to try and give you definitions around what we mean by general surgery and emergency general surgery. Hopefully going to explain the reason why we are in our contingency measures and also the reason why we are going out for public consultation to change our emergency general surgery service. I'm going to talk you quickly through the solutions and the standards that we need for emergency general surgery, and then also give you a brief overview of how our contingency model to date has been going. Okay, so to start off with general surgery, I want to tell you who we are and what we do. So three key questions that we need to answer is, what is general surgery? Okay, so general surgery is basically a sibling of the wider surgical family. We are one small element of the big overall surgical family. So you'll see the likes of urology, breast, ENT, trauma and orthopaedics, or other surgical specialties that we have in the trust. And then general surgery, we just form part of that. Okay, so general surgery is basically specializes in the abdominal organs. So really what we're talking about is diseases of the digestive tract. So we're talking about the stomach, the gallbladder, and the bowel. Now, back in the old days, general surgery used to be an all-encompassing terms, and the consultants who were coming through in the likes of Mr. Blake, Mr. Cranley, Mr. Brown, who used to be consultants in Daisy Hill, they would have been general surgeons who would have done everything. So they would have been involved in upper GI diseases, lower GI diseases, vascular, pediatric surgery. These days, what we're seeing within the last 10 years is really the general surgical specialty as a term no longer exists. And surgeons really specialise into what we call subspecialties. So these are specialised into upper GI, so as you can see there, the stomach, the gallbladder and the liver, or the lower GI, the bowel and the colons and the rectum. So general surgery really is a term sort of no longer exists. And it's part of the reason why we're seeing some recruitment difficulties in general surgery in the region and nationally. And it's all to do with the subspecialisation. Okay, so general surgery, the role of a general surgeon is largely split into two elements, and by far the biggest role is what we would deem the elective, the planned work. So this, the elective work encompasses things like your outpatient, so your GP referring you in, endoscopy, which is a offset of outpatients, so it's camera tests, operating, teaching and training, whereas the emergency element is a much smaller element of our service. Now, we totally understand that the term emergency does cause alarm, but really what we're referring to when we're talking about emergency general surgery is a term that encompasses our whole emergency service, and we talk about it in terms of the four A's. So we've got assessment, advice, ambulation and admission. So really it could be something as emergency surgery could be you're in your GP surgery and your GP contacts my team for unplanned advice. That would count as emergency surgery. Or it could be you attend an emergency department and after consultation with an emergency doctor, you need assessment and potentially admission from my emergency general surgery team. It's really important to outline what it isn't. So I suppose what a lot of the TV programmes would show you is somebody being wheeled off an ambulance and run down the corridor to surgery. That isn't what it is. Life and limb, where you need to be rushed to theatre is very, very, very rare. And in actual fact, only roughly 25% of the patients who we admit go on during their emergency admission to require a procedure under anaesthetic or perhaps a camera test. So the surgical element of our emergency surgery is really, really small. Another thing that we faced during this consultation is there's quite a lot of people confused around the general surgical involvement in the delivering of babies. We do not deliver babies. We have nothing to do with babies, and equally we have nothing to do with gynae. Okay, so this is just a model that shows this is what we used to do. So essentially we ran two exactly identical models on the Daisy Hill and the Craigavon site. And whilst the two models were the same in terms of they delivered emergency care to the patients, there's a couple of big differences. So this is just telling you a little bit about the number of surgeons. We were funded for 6 consultants on the Daisy Hill site and 9 consultants on the Craigavon site. But really, when it comes down to emergency surgery, it's not a numbers game in terms of consultants. It's really numbers games in terms of volume and volume of patients and volumes of operative cases. So I suppose we have faced challenges over a number of years delivering the emergency general surgery model across 2 sites. These challenges have impacted not only on recruitment, but also their training and retention of general surgery doctors, and have threatened the sustainability of the whole general surgery service within the Southern Trust. But really, these recruitment and retention challenges have been a symptom of operating an outdated service model. So our outdated service model is having 2 identical emergency general surgery services on 2 sites. And really what it comes down to is a hospital with low volumes of emergency surgery. So in surgery, we have something called a laparotomy, and it's really a marker of how busy you are emergency wise. So back when we were running the old model, in DC Hill there would have been one laparotomy a week, whereas in Craigavon there would have been more than one laparotomy a day. For example, on the Daisy Hill site, generally on any one day, we would have had between 11 to 14 emergency general surgical patients. And on the Craigavon site, we would have had between 45 to 50 emergency surgical patients. So this issue around volumes is something that has been experienced of lots of smaller hospitals locally and across the water. And what it is they find it difficult and we find it difficult to train, retain and attract doctors. So I suppose it's important to note that our hospitals are training grounds of our future surgeons and our future doctors. And in general surgery, our training was being threatened on the Daisy Hill site due to the low volumes of emergency surgery that we were doing each week. The trainees couldn't get the number of cases and exposure to the number of emergency admissions that they needed in order to proceed to the next step in their training, and it was threatening the impact within Daisy Hill of being able to retain those doctors. And if we didn't get our junior doctors, we certainly couldn't run routers. But not only that, is what we find is that our consultants themselves on the Daisy Hill site, due to the lower volumes of emergency admissions, were becoming de-skilled, and they were highlighting this as an issue that it was becoming a bit of a patient safety concern. There's also a couple of other differences between the Craigavon and the Daisy Hill site, and one of them is around the access to specialist resource. So where I spoke about earlier around our general surgeons and the way they are split, you have the surgeons here, upper GI and lower GI. We had an uneven split of, we had mainly our upper GI specialists on the Daisy Hill site and our lower GI specialists on the Craigavon site, when you really need them both together delivering their joint care. Unfortunately, the way things are set up, Craigavon is the unit where it has the critical care, the level 2, which our emergency patients require if they've gone through extensive surgery. We also have some radiology that's only available on the Craigavon site, such as MRI, and also specialist endoscopy, such as ERCPs, MRCPs, and also interventional radiology. So really what we find over a number of years is that there's been issues between running the two emergency general surgery units around suboptimal service in terms of access to resource, but also in terms of volumes, and really threatening them. Effectively, what it led to is what we call a revolving door of surgeons, in particular on the Daisy Hill site. So my surgical consultants basically identified that they needed to change if we were going to create a sustainable service that has an emphasis on high quality care and delivering the best quality outcomes. Then we really needed to change. So we needed to change, adapt, and modernise our emergency service. So I suppose what patients need is they need safe, higher quality emergency care that's delivered by a multi-skilled team that is supported by a full range of services. Okay, so we started looking at, and this was kind of in the last 5 years, what are the solutions? So we considered alternative models. We looked to our colleagues elsewhere in the region around how they were delivering their emergency surgical provision. We spoke to experts in emergency general surgery across the water in Scotland, England and Wales to try and glean the best evidence-based approaches to emergency care. And fundamentally, what all this came down to was you require a single site for emergency admissions and operations. And by doing this, it means that you can have your multi-skilled team, you've got the volumes that you need, and you can be supported by everything that is required for emergency general surgery. Whilst we were on our search for kind of evidence-based, the best approach models, the Department of Health actually released their emergency general surgery review, which outlined best practice standards that are required in delivering care to our patients. And my team were heavily involved in developing these standards. And I suppose the basic premise behind these are to develop safe and sustainable service models that allow the delivery of best practice in both emergency and emergency care. So whilst all this was going on and we were looking for new models, we unfortunately had a further resignation on the Daisy Hill site within my team, which left us with one consultant and two locum consultants. And it meant it was unsustainable and unsafe to continue on. So therefore, we moved into what we called contingency measures. And our contingency measures essentially came into place on the 28th of February of last year. And really what it means is that patients still attend the emergency departments they would originally attend. But if a patient who attends Daisy Hill Emergency Department requires general surgical advice or referral, the Daisy Hill Emergency Department team will contact my general surgical team via a special phone that's on 24/7, and they'll discuss the patient's care. And if it's felt that the patient needs to be admitted for general surgical care, they will be transferred to Craigavon. So there's a couple of things around that. They'll be transferred to Craigavon. They may be transferred by NIAS. But also we have brought in our own private, we've contracted private ambulances to help with the transfers. And we've also asked patients where it is appropriate to transfer themselves to Craigavon. So another important thing of the model is that patients, once a decision has been made in the Daisy Hill Emergency Department that they require general surgery input, they are transferred directly to a ward. So they do not have to go back through the emergency department on the Craigavon site. Some other big changes that we've implemented in the contingency model is that we have opened up access to my senior consultants Monday to Friday via phone for GPs. So GPs can contact the team should they have a patient with them or they're looking at advice. This is in hope that we can avoid patients needing to attend the emergency department and avoid hospital altogether. And we've also set something up called our surgical ambulatory unit. That means that one, GPs can refer into that unit, but also patients who attend the emergency department on either side, Craigavon or Daisy Hill, they might not necessarily need to be admitted to a surgical bed. We might be able to see them the next day in our unit and avoid an overnight admission, an overnight stay, and manage them in a different way. What we've learned from the contingency model so far is that on average we have three patients transferred a day from the Daisy Hill Emergency Department, and as I've already mentioned, this could be via NIAS, via private ambulance, or via public patient-owned transport. We've increased our ambulation of patients. So in the last year, we've seen a reduction in the number of patients that we admit surgically. So we've seen our admission numbers have reduced by 1,000. We've improved our GP access, and we have resource available. It's one of the questions that people ask, that what if a patient presents to the Daisy Hill site or indeed the inpatient on the Daisy Hill, one of the Daisy Hill medical wards, and they need emergency general surgical advice and are not fit for transfer? In these instances, we have plans in place for my team whereby we can still attend Daisy Hill almost as we always did. So in the last year, there have only been two occasions where the on-call general surgeon has had to attend Daisy Hill to see an emergency surgical patient. At all other times, patients have been fit to transfer and have transferred without issue. Okay. One more important point is we haven't restored the elective emergency side. So I still have surgeons in Daisy Hill Monday to Friday delivering elective theatre, outpatient clinics and endoscopy. So we've maintained our presence on site from that point of view. Basically, we feel that our model, the move to contingency with a single site, has improved access to specialist care, and it's providing a safer, higher quality service, and it's designing something that is sustainable for the future and really is the best thing for our patients. Thank you for listening, and I'm just going to exit out of this presentation, and we might come back in later on for some things about waiting lists, but in case people have got some questions that they'd like to ask about it, I'm sure you do.
Thank you very much. That's very informative. Appreciate that, Catherine. Is there anybody who wants to comment or ask a question to Catherine? And just mindful of the time as well, so not to hurry us or anything. I don't see any questions or comments coming in there, Catherine. Pete Burns, go ahead. Pete, you're on mute.
Sorry, I thought I'd never do that. Thanks for the presentation. Just a couple of questions. Firstly, to start on your last slide, we were talking about that you believe that it's the single site is more safer, service. We had a presentation from the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service just before, and I think you were in for all the presentations there, and you probably heard that. And they talked about in the last 6 months about the reduction in on-road vehicles dropping by 25%. And some of those figures are in line with the change that are made with Daisy Hill. So while you may say that the single site is safer and provides safer service, it doesn't provide a safer service to the areas that the ambulance response times are the worst in Northern Ireland. And that's what was quoted to us there. So it feels like a bit robbing Peter the tip all. And statements like providing a safer service sort of grind with us as elected reps when we hear the story on the other side is a less safe service. So I'd like a few comments on that. Also, you talked about some of the figures were put up there about the number of surgeries in comparing the two hospitals, Daisy Hill Hospital and Craigavon Area Hospital, and you talked about seven surgeries. I think it's, it was one a day was Craigavon, and around one a week in Daisy Hill, which is a 7-to-1 ratio. But it doesn't state the level of staff that were there to provide that. Because it's my belief that there are seven specialist surgeons, emergency general surgeons in Craigavon, and we had 2-to-1 in Daisy Hill. So that ratio would be correct in terms of the staff. But when there are simple statistics put up of a 7-to-1 ratio of the number of surgeries in one site, it looks quite compelling on why you'd move to that site. But you had seven specialist surgeons on that site, so of course you'd be doing more surgery on that site. So that needs to be explained when you're putting those stats out, because if you're putting a simplistic stat out like that, it's sort of, it blurs the lines, and it confuses people a lot more that there was a lot more going on in Daisy Hill. So I'd like a few comments around that as well.
Okay, so I suppose a couple of things to do with ambulance transfers and transfers between sites, and something that I didn't touch upon, that even when we had the two-site model, we did have a considerable volume of patients travelling and being transferred between sites and back and forth. So I'll give you an example. So, for example, somebody who might have come into Daisy Hill with abdominal pain and required MRI, they would be transferred from Daisy Hill to Craigavon for their MRI, then back again to Daisy Hill. Then the report would be available, and it showed the person perhaps needed gallstones. They would need to then be transferred back to Craigavon to undergo ERCP, and then they would go back to Daisy Hill, and it might find that in actual fact they needed further major surgery, in which case they'd be transferred back again to Craigavon. So there's always been this element of using ambulances to transfer patients kind of back and forth between Craigavon and Daisy Hill for the care that they needed. Now, I know you're probably going to ask me what is the volume and how do we show that. I don't know. We could probably work with NIOSH to pull that out. But there was always an element of transfer before that has now very definitely been reduced.
Well, can I ask that and say, on that question, if there was always an element of the transfer back and forth, how does that tally with over the last 6 months? The most recent 6 months, a 25% decrease in the on-the-road ambulances. That, we can't go back and say there was always an element of transfer. So what has different in the last 6 months? And when we look at that data, in January, we've seen the spike in the graph in that last presentation. that correlates with a change in service. So we can't accept that there's always been an element of it. We have to ask questions around why was that spike in January, and what is the reason for a 25% reduction in the honor? And we've got to get answers to those questions, because otherwise we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, and we can't come out and say that services are safer.
And then also, but we don't know, I suppose we'd have to show that it is attributed to emergency general surgery. Like that emergency surgery is a small element of everything, but we can certainly work with NIAS if there's any way to pull out how many, you know, what is happening in terms of general surgery. But we know on average it is 3 transfers a day, and not all of those 3 would be transferred by NIAS. And we are doing our best, I suppose, to release to reduce our reliance on NIAS with them, with the likes of employing private ambulance companies, with a view to we are looking to have our own internal transport long term in order to do some of those transfers that NIAS would be relied upon to do. So I personally, I don't think it can be all attributed to general surgery, but we'd have to work with NIAS to pull those figures, and we do work closely with them. And I suppose the from working with NIAS, and we've been linking in with the SWA, they were looking to us for advice when they've been in a similar situation, and NIAS's advice would be that the SWA followed something similar to us, whereby you ask patients to continue to attend the emergency department that they have always attended. So we are trying to minimise the ambulances coming out of areas. We are not bringing them to Craigavon unnecessarily. So that would be the thing I say around transfers. With regards to the numbers of the doctors on site and the emergency surgery, so I suppose the Daisy Hill site used to have a 1 in 6 RUTA, and that's what they were funded for, with a Craigavon site with a 1 in 9. But the 1 in 6 and the 1 in 9, but it really comes down to the volume of emergency surgery and the volume of patients coming in, which we have no control of. But basically what I'm saying is the Daisy Hill Wesley would have been on a 1 in 6 RUTA. They still had less exposure to emergency surgical cases than the Craigavon site due to the lower volumes that were attending. So the Daisy Hill consultants on the lower RUTA of a 1 in 6, whilst they would have been doing emergencies more frequently than a 1 in 9 RUTA, they still had lower volumes, and that was quoted to us by almost every surgeon that resigned to work elsewhere. So I'm talking about 6 surgeons, was around the de-skilling that they were finding that they were coming, and the de-skilling was not only with the consultants but also with the trainees.
Thank you. Councillor Riley, just keep an eye on the time. We're 5 minutes for a question. I'm really hoping it won't take that long, and 5 minutes for answer, if that's okay.
Yeah, I'll be quick, Madam Chair. Amy, I attended the Canal Court last week, and I was actually very impressed with the presentation given by the professor who's leading the review of surgery in Northern Ireland. And I actually think there's a bit of maybe fear-mongering and misunderstanding on the part of the public as regards to what's happening. But the thing that impressed me most was the fact that you have a better outcome if you're being operated on by a surgeon who is very proficient and doing this on a regular basis. And that swung it for me. That actually swung it for me. So I think it's important that we get the facts out to the general public and put people's minds at rest, because a lot of people are very anxious. I think there's going to be, you know, if you have an accident or an emergency, you're not going to be treated. So we need to put a nail in that. And but thanks very much. Very impressed with the work you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Councillor Riley.
That's great. Thank you. So I'm just wondering, there was 2 other speakers for here, but I'm assuming that's it covered, is it? No, you're coming in.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Okay.
Good afternoon or good evening. Yeah. Amy, if you're willing to re-share that screen, I'm conscious of your time, but there was a couple of other points on your correspondence that we just wanted to cover quickly. It was around the waiting lists across the piece. I suppose just to highlight, Amy's putting back up the presentation there. And just as she's going through that, just to say to elected members this evening, in terms of the Department of Health and the Strategic Planning Performance Group, you will know that from mid last year, there had been a revised service delivery planning process, with the priority being to improve activity levels across all areas back to pre-pandemic levels. So the trusts across the region, and I know South Eastern Trusts are in attendance tonight as well, the trusts across the region are being pushed to bring all services back to pre-pandemic levels, and we're being monitored on a monthly basis to do that. So I just wanted to highlight some of the key things today. So what you're seeing here is our inpatient and day case weights, and it's trust level, so it's the total weights across all of the trust. And what we can see is that weights are steadily increasing, and we are having a number of challenges, but we're working through those. Amy has alluded to some of those in her earlier presentation. But what we can see here is the total weights back from April 19 through to February 23. What you will see here in terms of the blue dots is while the numbers are increasing, we were still below the control limits. We have areas in orange where we can see that our inpatient and day case weights are increasing. There has been some improvement there from July, August through, where you can see that the weights are coming back down again. And I can tell you that the cause of these weights, and that's across all specialties, is down to theatre nurses and availability of theatre nurses. So what we can say that those are currently being addressed, and we have now just appointed 7 newly recruited theatre nurses. So we're hoping to see an improvement in our inpatient and day case weights in the coming weeks and months. Amy, if you're happy to proceed to the next slide, here again you will see outpatients. Again, a very, very steady increase in the total weights for outpatient services, and largely due to longer waiting lists as a result of COVID. And again, we are working through that. But we do have a number of consultant vacancies, and recruitment is ongoing. So those are the areas, number of areas that are affected, but recruitment is underway. So we do hope to see that. And I know Catherine is on here. We're starting to look at how we can modernise our outpatient services, really to start to address those waits in an innovative way, so that we can start to ensure that patients right across your elected area, Newry Moore and Down, and indeed the wider trust, can be seen at outpatient appointments as soon as possible by the appropriate person in the right place at the right time. So Catherine is currently leading a modernisation initiative to start to look at how can we ensure that people are seen as quickly as possible in the most suitable place. Amy, if you're okay to go ahead, we have next our primary mental health care weights. Historically, we had some very, very long waits for our adult mental health services, and we had put in place a project, and we'd seen sustained improvement there. But unfortunately, we had a number of staff changes, and at one point we were just carrying 10 vacant posts within those teams. But our recruitment is underway, and we hope again to see an improvement in our primary mental health care weights in the coming weeks. As I say, we have a number of vacant posts, but recruitment is underway there. And if you go on to the final slide there, Amy, around psychological therapies. Recruitment has been completed here, and staff have just been are just moving into post. Again, we're expecting to see an improved position in our psychological therapy. So we just wanted to highlight a couple of those key areas. I think that was it on the slide. But in reference to some of the comments, and Brian's with us tonight as well, in terms of our domiciliary care, it was referenced really around the weights. And Brian will be able to give us a wee bit more detail, but the Trust has invested £2 million of demography funding into our domiciliary care, and we are continuing to deliver a domiciliary care above our commissioned levels, but acknowledge that there is a waiting list for domiciliary care, and that is impacting on our discharges and indeed ultimately our flow through our system. So we are looking at our average length of stay, and are we getting discharge rates and all of those things to help patients flow through our system faster, which again will impact on the work that you've heard from Mark earlier this evening around ambulance handover times. So as a system, we're working better together, but we do have some work to do. So that was really just a very, very high level, Chair, over the waiting lists. But in terms of the comprehensive update that was mentioned around service availability and all things pertaining to Daisy Hill, Daisy Hill really is an essential part of the Southern Trust's hospital network, along with Craigavon and indeed South Tyrone. And last year, there was, sorry, in 2019, there was 56 just under 56,000 ED attendances at Daisy Hill. Daisy Hill, a high volume of births. There was over 8,000 inpatient admissions, and there was 82,000 diagnostic investigations that took place on the Daisy Hill Hospital. It's home to an area-wide renal unit, and Amy had highlighted that in her presentation earlier. But there is a number of key investments that have taken place in Daisy Hill in recent years, and many more planned. There's been the redevelopment of the sixth floor into the state-of-the-art paediatric unit. Again, it was highlighted in the presentation. There is a new outpatient department at Burnish House, a refurb of our emergency department there, and a new paediatric outpatient service at Clanrye House. Amy mentioned also in terms of the plans that are currently progressing for the elective overnight stay centre at Daisy Hill. And we again was mentioned around the diagnostic capacity on the Daisy Hill site. There's been a £9 million investment that was received in January of this year from the department to upgrade the electrical infrastructure at Daisy Hill, and that has already been initiated there in February. And at the moment, there is one permanent CT scanner at Daisy Hill, with plans to look at a twin diagnostic suite there. Again, capital reliant. We do need to have the low voltage, the LV electrical system upgraded to support an MRI. But again, that is something that we are looking forward to planning in the future. So there's Daisy Hill is very much a part of our infrastructure and a very important part of our infrastructure moving forward. And those are some of the key plans that we have underway. We're happy to take any questions. Just.
Thank you, Paula. I don't see any questions coming. So if that's the case, we'd be happy to move on. Lucky you, Paula.
Yeah, just to say thank you very much. It's been, you know, a pleasure to come along this evening from a trust perspective. And I think Brian's going to come in there as well, just to share, you know, in terms of all of the work that is underway. And it is a very challenging time for the health service, and the support that we've received from council and elected reps has been very much welcomed.
Thank you, Paula. Yes, Brian, go ahead.
No. Very briefly, your time's against you. The first one was just to offer condolences on your story. It was very touching. It makes it very real for us as a person who lives in Newry. I completely get it, you know, and the importance of us getting our services right and getting them better. So thank you for sharing and being brave enough to do that. The question that I was asked, or that I picked up, that was asked of Martin, touched into domiciliary care. I could talk to you for 5 or 10 minutes or whatever you'd want. If that's what you want now, we'll do that. Or if you prefer, in the interest of time, because I know all the colleagues are waiting to come on, we can give you a response, because you've also written, for by what's on the agenda today, Marie has written in respect of domiciliary care. We're just drafting that response. So I can incorporate my response that I would share now verbally with you into that and get it into you in hard copy. But I'll leave that over to you. I wouldn't want you to think that we were leaving here and not answering questions that were asked of us.
No, I'm very happy for you to take a few minutes now. I know Councillor McAvoy was very keen to get that response back and has done a lot of work in that sector. So if you could, we'd be happy enough for that, if everyone's okay.
I'll keep it short and sharp, because I know it's time's tight. I mean, patient flow, basically what was asked of Martin was touching on patient flow, and where exactly NIAS interfaces with us or any of the trusts, and where patient flow starts and where it stops. It's not just, and I mean, I know you know this, but the question we've been posed to Martin, is it a matter of a lack of domiciliary care? And the simple but complicated answer is it's multifactorial. It's more than just that. The whole patient flow topic, the area of patient flow, what I'll do is give you an assurance now that has the attention of our chief executive, as well as numerous directors across hospital community and also some of our corporate directors that Paul is representing today here from planning, as we work together to do whatever we can across the whole of the system to seek out the opportunities where there are to have an improved capacity and an improved experience for the people that we serve. The question to Martin was really right down, was it dorm care, the lack of dorm care preventing NIAS offloading of patients? And my answer is yes, in part. However, it's wider. To allow the ambulances, I'm being very, I suppose very simple with this, but to allow ambulances to respond to the next emergency call to any of our loved ones or to any of us, to allow them to be able to take the ambulance and go at haste, we need to support NIAS to offload the patients as they bring them to our ED departments. There needs to be space in the ED to let them take the patient out of the ambulance into ED. To allow that to happen, we need to increase the space in ED. Therefore, we need to make sure there's space in the wards so we can transfer the ED patients who need a bed up to the wards. To allow those ED patients to get into the wards, we need to get better at making sure that our medically fit patients leave the hospital and return either to their own home with or without a domiciliary care package or with direct payments, or to a care home placement, whether that be in a temporary or a permanent arrangement. Sometimes we will identify that somebody will need to go to a care home. They can't get the care home of their first choice. We ask them in the interest of vacating the bed to make space right throughout the chain to allow that ambulance to respond. We ask them to go to a neighbouring care home until such times as their care home of first choice becomes available. But we can have difficulties getting that agreement. So I suppose what I would ask our councillors and other colleagues on here today is that wherever they have an opportunity to influence constituents, friends, family, neighbours, that you would do so. We're not doing that to be cruel to anybody. We're doing that to free up an ambulance so we can respond to an incident at haste. Re-dorm care, we are also working to increase dorm care capacity. That's taking many forms. We're trying to work for all of those that we are giving dorm care. And today we have approximating 700 people that we need to identify a package of care for. But we have probably in excess of 5,200 people today who will have been experiencing domiciliary care maybe multiple times throughout the day. So we're working to try and release some capacity to work with individuals who probably have progressed a bit and don't need just as much. We'd like to try and free up some of that time, add it together, not to save money, to create more packages of care to allow the others to have their packages of care. We also are continuing to support our carers, and we've had special arrangements put in place to allow family members to be paid direct payments, which allows them to pay family members to provide the care directly themselves in the absence of us being able to find a source to provide the care, or because the family are stepping up and saying, well, we can make arrangements, but somebody else may have to leave employment, etc., to provide the service. So that's something that we continue to have in place. We are also continuing to have a great history of it in the Southern Trust through reablement and acute care at home and various other initiatives. We're trying to minimise the reliance of our service users, our patients, family, friends, etc., and actually make them more independent so they're less reliant on a need for domiciliary care. So that's my wee quick summary. I just wanted to throw a few of those out as tasters, just in case that generates any other questions. Thank you, Eva.
Thank you, Brian. And look, thanks for that. And we look forward to, I suppose, a written letter. And I can only imagine it'll be as comprehensive as that is. I don't see any questions coming in, so I am going to... Okay, Councillor Andrews, go ahead.
It's more of a comment. Maybe in the next mandate, maybe we could look at the structure of these meetings because, you know, each of our own trust here, there's a lot of health issues that are very much important to each and every one of us, and maybe, you know, a lot more time could be spent in each relevant trust area, you know, for the benefit of members. But I know it's 7:25, and, you know, it's been very important tonight for the Southern Trust and a lot of issues raised by yourselves for the Trust. So maybe in the next mandate, maybe we could look at the format of this meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Andrews. So if we're happy to move on, I want to thank all the attendees from the Southern Trust. So we'll move on then to item number 5, which is the South Eastern Trust And I want to just thank you for your patience. I know that we're running over on time here. So if you just want to take it away.
Okay, thanks very much, Aoife. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay, so thanks everyone. Many of you will know me. I'm Roisin Coulter. I'm the Chief Executive of the South Eastern Trust, and I'm joined tonight by Claire Campbell, who is our Head of Planning. First of all, yes, thank you, Councillor Andrews. I'm just not sure what's happened this evening, but certainly we were invited to come and meet with you between 7 and 7.30. So maybe we can look at that going forward. If we need more time with individual trusts, I think that's absolutely fine and we can do that. But just, the overlap that I have with the council is extremely important. So I wanted to come here in person this evening, and I came at 6 o'clock this evening to be here to be able to contribute and be part of the overall conversation about all services across our district with the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service and my colleagues in the Southern Trust. I'm not going to, certainly haven't been asked to talk about two specific services. What I would say starting off is to give you an overview of services across the South Eastern Trust area and some of the key challenges and issues that we're currently working through, and hopefully that'll be helpful for you all. Suffice to say, and I think it'll be reassuring for Council, is that a number of the issues that we've already discussed are common and are consistent in the Southern Trust and in the South Eastern Trust. So I have provided my response in relation to the domiciliary care question through to Council already, and the challenges and issues are extremely similar. I think really at the highest level, the space that we're in at the moment in health and social care in Northern Ireland is extremely concerning. That is the space that we are in, and we all find ourselves in, whether for myself and our teams and our staff working in the health service in Northern Ireland, or for you as local elected representatives, listening to all of the concerns that people living here have about our health service at the moment. Some of the key challenges that we know are the lack of political instability. It would be important to mention the financial environment. The lack of a budget is having an impact on our health service, and it is being made very clear to us. And again, we're going to have to think about how we work together in partnership going forward to prioritise services. We are being told that there is no more money coming into the health service in Northern Ireland. And so therefore, I'm just being very open, very, very realistic, and we will all need to work together, and we will do that to prioritise patient safety. It's a massive concern to me, and it really is. I haven't worked in the health service, as many of you know, all my career. I have never been as concerned about the inability to provide adequate access for services to our local population. The third big key challenge at the moment out there, as many of you will know, is industrial action is still ongoing by nursing staff and other Agenda for Change and other staff groups in the health service. And that will need to be resolved in some shape or form. There is further planned industrial action that will have an impact on services. And the fourth one is really about workforce availability. So, there is a big shortage, and you will all know this in many sectors that you overlap with. There's a big shortage of available workforce to work not only in the health service, but in other sectors in Northern Ireland. And I do think, and certainly, I've been having some conversations with other sectors about, how we maybe need to be more agile and more creative about bringing people in to help us work in the health service in Northern Ireland. So those are some of the key strategic issues for us all at this moment in time. There are a couple of things I think I want to sort of mention. And again, I'll pick up some areas maybe not mentioned by Southern Trust, though there isn't the overlap. But across Northern Ireland, as the health service has been asked to step up and respond to a high number of asylum seekers coming into Northern Ireland. So I know that many of you have been asked about that. So in the South Eastern Trust, we are currently caring for some 680 people who are seeking asylum. And I've been asked about, the funding stream for providing those services. And really, this is all quite new to all of us. It's in its infancy. There has been some dedicated funding provided for what's known as separated or unaccompanied children coming in. And we've been providing dedicated child health services for those young people. But there are also a higher number of families coming in to particularly in my area, the Down area. And I know that that's in other areas as well. So we need to look at how we're going to plan, you know, sustainable healthcare services for this population. And it is extremely important. We're working very closely with the public health agency. I know that you know, we've talked a little bit. I just wanted to mention maybe 2 minutes probably about domiciliary care because Brian covered it off in detail there for Southern. But somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago and they said, Roisin, if there was one thing that we could do to help the health service in Northern Ireland or to help us, you know, manage all the pressures, what would it be? And I said it would be the domiciliary care service. It would be the domiciliary care model. And, you know that I'm, you know, I really treasure, if you like, the relationship that we all have with each other. It's very, very important to us. I think the domiciliary care model is broken in Northern Ireland, and there needs to be, you know, fundamental change and a total overhaul of that model, because, you know, we need to really look and think about, you know, if we really are genuine about putting patients at the centre of everything we do, then what do older people that live here want? Well, they want to stay in their own homes. They want to be cared for in their own homes as long as possible. And they certainly want to spend the latter days of their life at home. So that is always, I think, so important for us all to remember. So it's not all about hospital services and more beds in hospitals. It is about really investing in community services. We've got, at this moment in time, almost 5,300 people receiving a care package in the South Eastern Trust alone, and an additional 500 patients each month coming on, look, you know, needing a care package. So, you know, that's a massive, massive agenda, well beyond the health service, because if you like, we're commissioned to provide the service, but it's very difficult to decide what the model should be. And I think for any new government, that is going to be absolutely, you know, right up there. There will have to be a change, in my view, about how we do provide domiciliary care services in Northern Ireland. A couple of things, again, always useful to update, and I know councillors are always keen on it, how things are going in the Down Hospital. And as you know, we are fortunate to have worked very closely with our council over the last sort of 10, 12 years to develop what we feel is a safe and sustainable model for our local population in the Down area, and it's something we are extremely proud of. We've made a number of the service changes that Daisy Hill are now proposing to make, and I suppose what I would say there is that we have been able to make those changes, and there is a precedent set for how we can provide the appropriate services in our rural areas. So the Down Hospital is really vibrant. Every single bed in the Down Hospital is full and has been throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. On not one occasion were their beds closed, and indeed there have been extra corridor beds put up on a regular basis. There are almost 90 beds in the Down Hospital, and it's complemented by two excellent services that I want to remind you of. So it is genuinely something to be proud of in terms of how you have worked with us to, you know, provide safe services and try and maintain our public confidence. So the urgent care service is going really well in the Down. We're continuing, and again, we want to continue to promote it. So again, from last January to this January, we've gone from seeing 1,850 attendances every month in the Down urgent care to 2,400 per month. And I'm keen to continue to stretch that. So that's by, you know, making sure that people know the service is there. Local people really like the service. They like phoning first and no one had time to come up. But the other side of it is, and I always did promise this, you know, it wasn't a matter of just opening it and resting on our laurels. We said we were going to try and expand the types of conditions that we're seeing, and we have been doing that by getting additional people in post. 85% of people who phone the Down Urgent Care Centre are seen in the unit, and only 16% are transferred out to another hospital. So that's really what you would want to see. In terms of the other, as you know, we've campaigned and got really good investment for a number of regional surgical services in the Down, and the cataract service is really going very, very well. So there are 200 People receive a cataract operation every single month in the Down, and I can do more. So if there was more investment, our teams can do more in the Down. And, you know, I wouldn't underestimate. I mean, just saw actually a programme at the weekend. You know, the impact of older people needing a cataract surgery is, you know, very significant on their health. And I think it's so important that our local hospitals play a key role in providing those services. Moving on then to, and again, this council is really, really strong in, you know, having mental health as one of your priorities. And as you know, we work together in community planning, and mental health, whether it's pre or post the COVID-19 pandemic, is an absolute priority for us. So mental health services in Northern Ireland, again, this is why you'll hear the level of concern that I have across a range of services. So I have never been as concerned about mental health services in Northern Ireland as we are. And the reason for that is there are more and more people that need acute inpatient mental health services. That's across all trusts in Northern Ireland. So, I mean, I can cover the region in relation to that. So all of the inpatient beds are full and beyond. So there are more people in the mental health inpatient wards than there are beds available. And that is extremely challenging. So it's challenging for patients, for GPs. It's also very challenging for our staff, if you can imagine. So on a positive note, we have just commissioned and built a new facility here actually on the Downshire site, which is a mental health psychiatric intensive support unit. It's got 6 beds in there, and thankfully that would be a really nice environment and an appropriate environment for those patients. But today there are 11 patients in that unit, not 6. So the bed occupancy is 180%. And I do not see any, as I said to you, there is no more money for the health service. So there's no point in us talking about, you know, commissioning, you know, additional services. But compounded by that, there's another big issue. And again, I think it's just useful, hopefully, for you all to be aware of. As you know, with all of the challenges regarding the Muckamore Abbey inquiry, which is a hospital for people with learning disability, there is no inpatient service available for the South Eastern Trust patients. Other trusts do have inpatient services, and we are trying to work together regionally, but this is having a very significant pressure on us all across the region. So whenever somebody with a learning disability needs admission to a learning disability inpatient unit, there isn't sufficient capacity available, because we're not using the Muckamore Abbey. So what's actually happening, and it's compounded in the South Eastern Trust, is that sadly people with significant learning disability are being admitted into mental health wards. That's not an appropriate environment, and our staff are not trained in learning disability. I am extremely concerned about it, and it's something that we're trying to address as a region, but the solutions, you know, aren't coming quick enough to help those people that we're caring for every single day, day in, day out in this period in time. So, you know, the good thing, I think, hopefully with having this conversation with all of you is, you know, I'm trying to give you an overview of all of our services, of our entire services, and share with you some of the challenges. You know, my team always say to me, Roisin, end on a positive note. There still is lots of good happening. Of course there is. The thing, I suppose, that, you know, you will find, and again, to thank you, is, you know, the vast majority of people still who receive health and care, you know, right across Northern Ireland, they feel they receive a high quality service. You know, whether they're thanking you or they're thanking me, you know, there still is very positive feedback about the services. But we need to look at some way of really sustaining the health service in Northern Ireland in the medium to longer term, because we've just been hearing information from the Nuffield Trust and the Fiscal Council that's outlining that the spend per head of population in Northern Ireland on health is greater than in other areas of the UK. And what's compounding that as well is that we're not actually able to deliver better patient outcomes. So that's why we need to think about there will need to be more changes in services, and you'll be aware of lots of services changing right across Northern Ireland, and that is positive work, I feel, in terms of agreeing what services are appropriate to be provided in which centres, and really maximise all of our sites. always remember that we need all of the facilities that we have, because you can see very clearly that there's more demand than capacity. So, you know, in a reassuring way, in the South Eastern Trust area, we need all the hospitals we have, and we want to develop what additional capacity we have. That's primarily in whether it's day case surgery or complex day surgery. We can do more if there is the availability of doing that. So, and the final thing I always end up with is that our staff are sticking with us despite all the challenges that, you know, and I'm sure you've heard as well, you know, staff, we recognise, I talk to staff every single day, they are working under what we would call relentless pressure. And a number of you will know that we've had very useful engagement, you know, during the pandemic, but the pressure actually hasn't alleviated for staff working in the health service at the front line. So I have to spend an awful lot of time thinking about how do we support staff to continue to do these roles, to continue to work in the health service and to attract people into the health service. So that is a priority for us. So happy to take any comments or questions, but hopefully that's a comprehensive review prior to us heading into the local election period. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, and I couldn't agree more. That, you know, and I want to thank the nurses and doctors and the staff in the hospitals. And it's very clear, you've made a very valid point there that an executive is needed now to invest in health, to recruit more doctors and nurses and tackle waiting lists, to ensure that, you know, that health services can be delivered safely, and to help support the staff, as you said, and to future-proof the health care system. So, look, thank you for that. There is, let me see, a question there from Councillor Hanlon.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks, as always, Roisin, for a comprehensive report, I suppose, for want of a better word, and taking the time out. And I know we are overrunning tonight, so appreciate that. I would make a comment that I agree in investing in the community services is really, really important, and supporting elderly and vulnerable people to be able to stay at home is just really of vital importance. It's really worrying, I suppose, that you're sitting with 180% bed capacity in mental health at the minute, and it just shows the level of issue that we have with mental health, and I suppose it's being compounded with what we've all dealt with over the last number of years. What I wanted to pick up on was, it's undoubtedly what I hear as an elected rep is the service in the down is second to none, and the staff are amazing. But really wanted to pick up on the route of how they actually get to the down. In terms of, I'm hearing a few issues that people are not getting through on urgent care, on the telephone line. They're maybe trying all morning, and on occasion they've like landed to the hospital, which we're trying to discourage, obviously. And then they're being told to go back out into the car park and make a phone call. And also potentially for elderly people, whereby they're maybe ringing their GP and they're being told to go to the Ulster. And I know of one case where the lady knew herself she wasn't fit to go to the Ulster and resisted, and did get into urgent care and did get dealt with and spent a few nights in the down, and luckily is home right as rain again. But I suppose my point is that protracted route of how you actually get to see a face-to-face medical practitioner. So I suppose my question is there been any like patient-centred review about how they find the urgent care facility, and how that, you know, how they find the access to it? Because undoubtedly it's working, but it's just how they're actually getting to the person they need to be in front of.
Yes, thanks very much, Una, and thank you for that feedback. And I'll definitely follow up on it. So I'll pick up all the points. Yes, the feedback is very positive. So we do regular patient experience reviews, and we did like two dedicated surveys, well high in the 90% of people who are accessing the down urgent care are highly satisfied with it, and in terms of how they access it, etc. There hasn't been one issue. Now, I will follow up in terms of the call times to pick up. I did have a bit of a query about the Lagan Valley, actually. There was an issue with the phones at one point, but I haven't had one. Now, I haven't had any emails or anything at all with anyone having difficulty accessing the Down, but urgent care. But I'll follow it up because we monitor it. So I know how many calls are coming in and I know how long they're being taken to pick up. So very happy to pick that up. And the other one is that, interestingly, for people who, maybe you mightn't be aware of it, but it'll be useful for you to be aware of it. We've introduced just over the winter there, you know, the type of patient that you talk about there, someone we would call as a frequent attender to the Down, who's local, maybe has chronic conditions and needs admitted to the Down hospital, you know, on a regular basis. Well, obviously we don't really want them at all to go to the Ulster Hospital. We want to try and keep them in the Down. So we've introduced what we call a passport. And this is where the doctor has reviewed the patient, and we've agreed this with the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. So we have 15 people now with a passport, just, you know, just calling it that, a passport to the Down. So if something happens to that patient, they're well known to us, they're well known to our nurses and doctors in the Down, and the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service know about them, so they know to take them straight to the Down. So they don't go to the Ulster, and that's much better. I mean, the other side of it as well is, as you know, like I push every single day, is that, you know, if we have any bed availability in the Down, which we tend not to, we don't have any bed availability, you know, that's a, you know, the beds are full all day, every day. So we're maximising the use of our beds in the Down. But, and part of that is what we call repatriation. So if somebody's in the Ulster and they're fit for transfer back to their local hospital, then we're prioritising that as well to get them back locally as quickly as we possibly can. So, hopefully that's answered that.
Yeah, it has, and it's interesting to hear that. How do you qualify for the passport though? Because I'm talking about maybe somebody who's like 88 years of age and has extremely high blood pressure or whatever it might be. You know, they're not going to have that passport until they actually get in. So I suppose not that I'm any expert on health, but you know, I had thought maybe like a triage or something in the Down for people who are vulnerable like that to have health conditions. Rather than just being directed into A&E in the Ulster, which we all know they're going to sit there for like at least a few hours if they're lucky, but on occasion it could be up to 48 hours sitting in in a corridor on a chair, unfortunately, at peak times.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% on board with everything you say. So there's two things. There's the passport, and then there's what we call, don't forget about FERA. Do you remember the Frail Elderly Rapid Assessment Service in the Down? We've got that now in each of our hospitals. So someone, say, like you're mentioning there, somebody with, you know, who's elderly with high blood pressure, they would be referred up to be seen by all the different specialties in Frail Elderly Rapid Assessment. It's really just to see whether they need it. The key thing is, does the person need admission to hospital or not doing it? So, you know, if they're definitely needing admission and it's a first-time episode, they might be suitable for GP admission into the Down Hospital, admission through the urgent, there's lots of different ways in, or through the urgent care centre. But how they get the passport is if there's criteria set by the consultant, really knows the patient really well, you know, and they're for somebody who's frequently coming in. The numbers are quite small, but it's very, very important for those patients that I want to be able to get those patients in, because, you know, they're known to that team in the Down, and it's working very, very well. So it's not really for someone with like a one-off acute episode, and they need to go to the most appropriate place. Hopefully that's...
Yeah, that's more than enough. It's a good explanation. Thank you. Roisin, I'll not hold up the meeting any further. Thanks a million.
Thank you for that input. Okay, next we have Councillor Sharvin, yeah?
Yeah, thanks, Chair, and thanks, Roisin. And as always, you're very open and honest with us, and I think we all fully appreciate that, both in this forum and even with the Down Community Health Committee as well. You are very forthcoming with the information and willing to listen. But touched on a couple of things. As Una rightly says, I think probably most of us are shocked at the levels of... not necessarily shocked at the levels of admissions for the mental health ward, the psychiatric ward. You know, there is from COVID and other areas of mental health, there is certainly challenges. Is the challenge there, Roisin, that there's just no money to further commission beds, or is there the challenge of bed space available? So that's one question. Next question, you know, you even touched on the Dunsinlery care package. Councillor Trainor brought a motion to council just last month, actually, around this call on for a full review, and the council fully endorsed that and agree, and that can help support alleviate it. So that's just a comment. Third point, as you probably are aware, Down Community Transport are facing similar constraints that you are experiencing from a DFI perspective through their Dial a Lift service, which they openly state a lot of that is to bring to hospital appointments or get to see a GP. Obviously, with that funding cut hanging over them and them not knowing what the future potentially holds, you know, there's a lot more pressure on what accessibility to hospitals and health services will be. And has the South Eastern Trust taken in consideration what additional pressures that yous will have if that Dial a Lift service is not continued to be funded at the level that it is? Just another point, you know, some of the constituents that contact me, and I actually think I said this to the last time you were here, they're choosing to wait until Monday. You know, if they fall a little over the weekend, they know they're not going to be seen, you know, by a consultant, and some are choosing to wait, and surely that is a concern that yous are continuously taking under review, and what is the plan there. And then the last point that I want to make is Strangford Clinic. It continues to not be available, and I was in touch with some of your colleagues last week again on this. Obviously, it is a trust building, but it's the GP that runs out of it. Is there any way that the trust themselves can apply pressure for some sort of outcome? Because it's rightly unfair on the residents and the patients within Strangford and the surrounding areas to be continuously asked to travel into Downpatrick to see their GP whenever there's a fine building within Strangford that has been there for a long time, that was fought to be kept open not too many years ago by the community, and that they're continuing to be neglected. What can the trust do in this situation? Because Claire Marie rightly does say it is now up to the commissioner to resolve this, but the trust surely, as the owner of the building, have a role to play in this as well.
Okay, thank you, Gareth. Good to see you. You've got four or five questions there, so you know I'll run through them. But as ever, you know, all of you, we have a very good relationship anyway. So if there's anything further, you know, because there's a lot in what you've said, you're constantly in touch with us, all of you, anyway. And hopefully you'll find that, you know, we're always trying to respond in a timely way to give you the information, and, you know, happy for it to be ongoing. I mean, mental health, you ask about the reasons, and it's all of the reasons. That's why I'm so concerned about a number of services. So for mental health, you know, the financial position is a massive issue, the lack of available, you know, suitably qualified mental health nurses is a challenge. But saying that, there will have to be a way found, you know, to take forward the recommendations of the mental health strategy for Northern Ireland. And, you know, it's not only about the hospital beds for mental health patients. You will know this anyway, but it's about the alternatives and admitting people into an inpatient bed as a last resort. We're involved working regionally on that. And I mean, again, any new executive, this will need to be, along with domiciliary care, mental health will need to be right up there in terms of how we're going to deliver for Northern Ireland. One of the positive things is, you know, you heard me saying positive quite a wee bit tonight, so it must be a good day. they're talking about the regional mental health service. So what we're planning to do, and there's been a team of people looking at best practice in other parts of the United Kingdom and in the south of Ireland, is really, you know, we're going to have one service. It's probably going to take about 5 years to develop, but you know, our services will be provided by all the different individual trusts, but it'll be provided, you know, as one coordinated service. So, you know, that's very positive, and there's some good work. You know, and if you were to ask about that, there is progress going on in relation to that. The domiciliary care piece, you're saying, you know, it needs, I did read about the motion there for review, but, you know, again, I would remind you that there was a review of adult social care in 2018, which was called Power to People. And due to all of the issues that you'd be more aware of than me, it has not been, the recommendations of that review have not been implemented. So that review is sitting there, and we're supportive of the recommendations. But the key thing, you know, really, again, you know, some of this comes back to workforce, some of it comes back to financial, how much money has been put in to domiciliary care in Northern Ireland, and the rates need to increase. Many of you, I'm not here with the answers, but you know, it's a very different model in Northern Ireland. So in England, the councils provide social care. The councils, you would be responsible for providing domiciliary care, and also that it is not free. It is means tested. So again, that's why I'm saying there, you know, it's broken, and part of the reason will be the funding available to support it. Now, we pride ourselves in providing an integrated service in Northern Ireland, which is, you know, acute and community care. So, you know, we feel that when we do it, we can do it very, very well. But I just think there does need to be that implementation of the strategy. The Down Community Transport, I'll take offline, Gareth, and get back to you on that in terms of the dial a lift and get you the specific information. But I think all of you have said tonight, and we heard Mark from NIAS earlier, the concerns regarding constraining budgets in NIAS, we would be concerned then about the NIAS ability for non-emergency patient transport. So we need to keep very close on that. And again, we need to see what is possible and what is not possible in terms of people accessing care. Strangford Clinic, again, I'll get back to you on that in terms of specifics, because I know it doesn't be applied to everybody, but I think, you know me, I'm absolutely open and honest. This has been around for 10 years, and the GPs have not moved back to provide the outreach service from the Down to the Strangford Clinic. So, you know, if you ask my level of confidence about their intention to do so, I think it'll be very challenging. I know what you're saying about, you know, it is up to the commissioner. I actually don't think there's anything I can do. And if there was, you know, I would do it. I have written to them, over the years, and, there was no positive outcome in this. So what I would, and I actually did ask a few months ago to my director of finance and estates, is to say, you know, it is a good facility, Strangford Clinic, mm-hmm. and, you know, we were providing some services from there, and I am open to the opportunity of maybe, you know, working with our local community to see, you know, can we share access with other services who might wish to help or provide services in the community. And she told me there were some issues maybe with that, but, you know, I'm still keen to look at how we might be able to do that. I do think, again, you know, for all councils, but, you know, some councils are more challenged, and, you know, it's good to mention for all of us, GP services in Northern Ireland, folks, is under, you know, tremendous strain. And, you know, if we were in a different council meeting in another area of Northern Ireland tonight, we would be having a conversation all about the sustainability of GP, the GP model and the GP services. So, you know, that's why even Gareth, we're in a different space than we were 2-3 years ago. 13 practices have handed back their contract to the Department of Health. And they are the GPs who call themselves, you know, unique small businesses. They're self-employed, and they're not able to make ends meet, and they're giving back their contracts. So the trusts are being asked to pick up actually providing GP services. So again, I think that we, and you know, there may be positive and there may be opportunities in that in the future, but for now, it's a massive, massive challenge. So, you know, in Hollywood, many of you know Hollywood and Bangor, we have had to, as a South Eastern Trust, take on Priory and Spring Hill Surgery, which is one of the largest practices in all of Northern Ireland with 15,000 patients needing to receive GP care. So that's the big picture piece on this. So in the Down area, in the South Eastern Trust area, we have 13 GP practices. And to date, you know, touch wood, they're all able to, you know, support their local communities. And one of the things that will come to your agenda is that one of the things that GP said is important to makes a difference to them, and you'll know where I'm going here. It's they say they need the multidisciplinary team around them. So, you know, the whole initiative for multidisciplinary teams in primary care and the Down was the pilot alongside a practice in Derry, Londonderry. So the GPs are more sustainable if they have the health visitor, the district nurse, the mental health practitioner, the social worker wrapped around their practice. Now, that has been possible in the Down area, and the outcomes are absolutely fantastic. Patients and local community love it. But mm-hmm. the difficulty is there isn't the money available to roll that out. And again, whenever Department of Health and an executive are going to be asked for what are the priorities, if you think about the conversation we've just had tonight, there are so many priorities, and we're going to have to think about what we will do, you know, where we will invest. But, you know, keeping people well, preventing them becoming ill in the first place, and then trying to provide as many primary community care services to avoid hospital treatment is absolutely where we need to be. So hopefully that's helpful to you, Gareth, and if there's anything in particular, do come back to me.
No, brilliant as always, Roisin. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think that all of it has been so informative this evening, and I'm really, really glad that we were able to have this meeting and discussions and questions answered. But look, sorry, very, very sorry that it run over, but I suppose it was important that we get all the detail. And I suppose just for councillors to write in for any issues that maybe you didn't get to ask tonight. All right, so Sinné, Gara, Mila, Mayogav to you all, and we will see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks.
Good night. Bye. Thank you.
Good night.